I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1688. That was the day Germantown Quakers gathered to petition against slavery in the first documented anti-slavery protest in America. Quaker colonists in Barbados began to question slavery in the 1670s. By 1688, founder of Germantown, Francis Daniel Pastorus, and three other Quakers met at Thones Cudner's house to craft a petition. They urged their fellow congregants to abolish slavery. The petition detailed its opposition to the importation, sale, and ownership of slaves. Rooted in the Golden Rule, "Do unto others as they would do unto you," the men questioned why Christians would own slaves when they would not own each other. They argued that slaves had broad universal rights, including the right to engage in slave revolts in order to assure their freedom. The petition traveled its way through the Quaker network, but many felt it was too weighty a matter on which to take a position. Those Germantown settlers who felt strongly about ending slavery left the Quaker community for the Mennonites. Over the course of the next century, Quakers in Germantown would craft strong anti-slavery petitions that influenced the broad Quaker community in Philadelphia to take a formal stand. By the time of the American Revolution, Philadelphia Quakers published numerous attacks on the institution in Benjamin Franklin's newspaper. They formally banned the ownership of slaves at their Philadelphia yearly meeting in 1776. Throughout the region, Quakers routinely raised funds for those who had escaped bondage to start new lives and help them integrate into the Quaker communities. Quakers would continue to play a prominent and active role in the abolitionist movement and the Underground Railroad. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. And welcome, brothers, sisters. Well, it would be helpful if you started recording. And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. First foremost, Democratic oversight. About time. Democrats holding hearings on issues that face we the people. About time. Hearings on health care, hearings on infrastructure, hearing on wages and jobs, and tax returns. Lots to investigate. And let's not forget all of the Trump-Russia stuff that thoroughly needs to be investigated this time instead of just a sham show that we saw during the last 2 years, and we'll get to some of that as well. But I wanted to start today off with, I was watching the testimony coming out of one of the Democratic hearings on the minimum wage. Look, I've been saying for a very long time that we need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage standard, that, you know, we need to put reward back to work, that, you know, going back to that thing that I grew up believing when I was a kid. You work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead. And as I was watching the testimony, one guy in particular grabbed my attention, a guy named Terrence Wise. Terrence is a fast food worker from Kansas City. He sat down and gave one of the most heartfelt testimonies that I've seen. In fact, you know, when we aired it on our radio program, it actually made my wife cry. You know, it's one of those things where it's not a unique story, but every time you hear it, it should grab you by the heart. It should grab you by the soul. And should say to you that, you know, in the wealthiest country in the world, this shouldn't be the reality. So I'm going to do something I've yet to do on TV. We did it for the first time on the radio program. First time in 14 years. I want to play the entire 6-minute testimony. It's one of those things that I'll tell you, I was, it grabbed me. And it was one of those things. So I want to play this testimony because I think in its entirety is something that should most certainly be seen. So here's the testimony of Terrence Wise.
Thank you, Chairman Scott and Ranking Member Fox and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Terrence Wise, and I'm a 39-year-old second-generation fast food worker from Kansas City, Missouri. and I'm honored to speak with you today about the Raise the Wage Act. I began fighting for $15 an hour and a union 6 years ago because I knew just asking my boss for a raise in benefits wouldn't do. I felt the struggle of raising a family on low wages my whole life. It began in South Carolina. I grew up in government housing with my two brothers and sister. My mother worked full-time at Hardee's for 30 years, and my dad served as a cook in the military. My mom would wake me up at 4 a.m. early before she left for Hardee's, and it was my job to get my siblings up and ready to go to school. It was also my job to be home when the mailman arrived to sign for the food stamps. Even with two full-time incomes and food stamps, my family still had to skip meals. One winter, I didn't even have a coat until my guidance counselor at school gave me one from the lost and found. Hardworking people with two full-time incomes shouldn't live like this in the richest nation on earth. I was a great student, and by the eighth grade, I was in all advanced placement classes. My teachers were saying things like, "Terrence, you're gonna be great. You're gonna do good things." I wanted to be a Gamecock at the University of South Carolina. I was gonna be a writer. But I went to work at the age of 16 to try to help my family survive. One day I came home from school, it was no lights, no food in the fridge, so I got my first job at Taco Bell, making $4.25 an hour. But I knew my family needed the money desperately. My first paycheck was $150, and it all went on the light bill. One job wasn't enough, so I got a second job at Wendy's. I tried to balance both work and school. I had all A's in my classes, but I started falling asleep in classes. And now teachers were asking me, "Terrence, what's wrong?" I told them I was working two jobs, had to survive. I didn't need AP calculus to run the numbers at home. It wasn't enough to survive. It wasn't even enough for basic necessities. I had left school in my dream of college, and at 17, I dropped out and became a full-time worker. And I've been working in fast food ever since. Now I have a family of my own. I have three daughters, ages 17, 15, and 13, and my fiance is a home healthcare provider. Neither one of us make enough money to make ends meet, and I've worked two jobs most of my life. I'd leave for Burger King at 2 o'clock, then leave from there and arrive at McDonald's and work the overnight shift, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. I couldn't get my jobs to line up the off days, so sometimes I'd work weeks without a day off. My family has been homeless, despite my two incomes and my fiance's. We've endured cold winters in Kansas City, homeless in our purple minivan. I'd see my daughters in the back tossing and turning. Try waking up in the morning and getting ready for school and work in the parking lot. That's a memory I can never take away from my children and something a parent should never have to go through. You should not have multiple jobs in the United States and nowhere to sleep. I work for McDonald's, the second largest employer in America, and I still rely on food stamps and Medicaid. Like other working people in America fighting for 15 in a union, I want to stand on my own. I want to provide my girls with three meals a day and give them the opportunities I didn't have. This movement has changed our entire country. Many people didn't believe $15 an hour was possible, but it has become a reality for 22 million workers across the country. 75% of voters in Kansas City voted for a $15 minimum wage in 2017. Workers won that victory by taking big, bold action, like going on strike. We even slept on the steps of City Hall for a week in our Fast for 15. It was a huge victory for us until the state legislature preempted the minimum wage, returning it to $7.65. Missouri voters increased the minimum wage in 2018, but we're still not achieving $15 an hour, the minimum we need to support our families. That's why we need Congress to take action to raise the federal minimum wage. I often imagine what $15 an hour would mean for me and my family. It would mean I could keep food on the table, we wouldn't have to worry about doing homework in the dark, and I could get the girls school supplies whenever they needed them. But what would $15 an hour really mean? It means that my daughters could meet their grandmother for the first time. She lives in South Carolina, and we just have never been able to afford to travel to meet her. Low-wage workers like me will continue to organize and fight for economic justice. My coworkers and I have lifted our voices from the steps of City Hall in Kansas City, at the White House, and now here today on Capitol Hill. Everyone who works in this country deserves access to the promise that America made to each and every one of us: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And $15 an hour brings us closer to living out our values as a nation. The Raise That Wage Act will do just that. And I urge members of this committee to raise the wage, you know? Act quickly to pass this bill. Thank you, and I look forward to answering any questions.
I gotta tell you, I listened to that, and I don't know how you can not, I don't know how you can not be moved by that. There are a couple of things. First, the image, especially now, during this time of year, with the weather being as cold as it is, the snow, can you imagine, can you imagine for a second, you know, working as hard as this guy works, two jobs, the wife works, the fiance works, being homeless, living in your minivan, your kids sleeping in the cold, seeing their breath rise. I mean, it's one of my greatest fears. And I do have some experience in this. You know, look, as a kid, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were almost homeless a number of times. So I understand that. I understand, you know, going to the cupboards and there being nothing there. I understand poverty. I understand what it means. But from my perspective, I can't imagine a parent having to look at their children and know that there's nothing they can do to help them. And that's the kind of world that we're in. You know, and you know, the part that made my wife cry was, well, that and the fact that these kids, you know, 17, 15, and 13, have never met their grandmother. I mean, it was just, you know, it's just heart-wrenching. But yet, this is the reality of millions of workers across this country. And, you know, as I was listening to him speak, a very articulate speaker, can you imagine what he could have done if at that moment when teachers went from "you're going to do great things" to "what's wrong with you?" At that moment, had someone intervened and said, "hey, what's going on? How can we help? How can society help make sure that the lights don't get turned off, make sure that there's going to be some food on the table, make sure that the wages that mom and dad are working, because they were hardworking people too, working in low wage jobs, how we can make their lives a little bit better so that you don't have to work a job or two jobs and try and figure out how to juggle that and schoolwork. At that moment, had someone intervened, at that moment, had someone, something changed this dynamic, what could that guy have achieved? And what could millions of other people achieve? Now, look, I'm in no way diminishing the work that he does. I'm in no way diminishing restaurant work, fast food work, retail work. All work to me has value. And that value should be a reasonable living wage. Now, you get people who say, well, you know, why not just pay him $100 an hour? Don't be ludicrous. The reality is our minimum wage was much higher in the past. You go back into the 1960s, it was a little right around half of the median income. Now it's about a third of the median income. So simply by raising it up to back to that half level would be a huge step forward in helping people to be able to afford to exist. And I know people are going to say, but Rick, they get all of these subsidies. They get food stamps. They get heating assistance. They get rent assistance. Look, they don't want it. They want their work to be rewarded. Just like you, just like me. They want to make sure that they can make it on their own without subsidies from our government. And understand, what we've done is we've created an environment where big business has set up their models based on cheating workers out of wages. And, well, we the people making up the difference. All the while demonizing those people who do those jobs. absolutely ridiculous. And Terrence was right. You don't need AP calculus to realize the math doesn't add up. I argue we need to see an increase in the minimum wage, and good on the Democrats for at least pushing in that direction. And that's going to take the rest of us. It's going to take you. It's going to take me. Love to hear your thoughts. What did you think of Terrence's testimony? Are we just going to let that go? Or are we going to take this to heart and realize there are millions of Terrences out there who are hardworking, dedicated people? The strike at Wright State University in Ohio that began on January 22nd ended this past Monday as faculty returned to the classroom after the tentative agreement was reached on Sunday. Wright State University's president said the deal was going to save the university as much as $4 million a year. And the question I have is, if it's saving the university $4 million a year, where'd it come from? Did it come from the professors who are the ones who, well, the ones that provide the services that the institution provides to students? Well, I'm here to share some thoughts on the strike, the agreement, and, well, what this means. I've asked Rudy Fichtenbaum to come talk with us. He's a professor emeritus of economics there at Wright State, also the national president of the American Association of University President Professors. Rudy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, pleasure to be here with you today.
So walk me through this. Let's start with the strike. What put you in that position? What made you do it?
Well, we have been trying to negotiate with the university. We started negotiations in January of 2017. They then broke off the negotiations, and we ended up going to fact-finding. Throughout all of this, we tried to get the university to negotiate. Even after we got the fact-finding report, and even after we rejected the fact-finding report, we tried to get them to negotiate. We told our members that when we asked them for a strike authorization, that, we were not going to call a strike unless the university imposed. And on January 4th, the university did impose, and that's what resulted in the strike.
And as I understand, like you said, you had been negotiating for, nearly 2 years, and 15 months outside of the contract. And at some point, you got to go, something's got to happen, and you can't continue to negotiate on forever. But like you said, when the university imposed their will upon you, you had to do something, and this kind of left you in this position. Now, you can look, the second longest strike, I think, in higher education history is what I'm being told. Was it worth it?
Ultimately, I think that'll have to be for the members to decide. But, from where I sit, I think it was, because what was at stake here was really, would faculty be able to have a union effectively represent them? This was really a struggle over power and control. The university decided that they could try and use a financial crisis in order to really try and break the union. And almost all of their proposals that we ultimately were able to fight off were all aimed at that, whether it was, controlling workload, and being able to arbitrarily assign people to class. That's something that, again, you can use to punish people or reward people, or whether it was taking away the employment security from our non-tenure track faculty, who currently, after 6 years, have a continuing appointment, which is actually in many ways very similar to tenure in that they cannot be dismissed except for just cause and for certain kinds of economic circumstances. And that, of course, allows them to be able to speak up and to have a voice at the university. And it was the same thing with language that we had on merit pay. Of course, everybody knew there wasn't going to be a pay increase, but yet the university was insistent on using this as an opportunity to get rid of the language that we have on merit pay, where, you know, there are certain objective criteria based on annual evaluations that are used to distribute that money whenever there is that money. They want to be able to use it just to reward their friends and punish their enemies. And, you know, with and then on with healthcare, it was basically taking away our right to negotiate over compensation. So, you know, when you add all of that up, it was basically trying to silence the voice of the union, which, of course, have been very critical of all of the, you know, financial mismanagement of the university. And I think they just saw this as an opportunity to try and break the union.
Yeah, they saw the crisis that they created as an opportunity to take advantage of their workforce. Let's talk about the financial crisis, because I'm told that, and again, I see this happening in other places across the country as well, that universities are taking on, you know, other things outside of their core operation. And I guess real estate was a big thing at Wright State University. I guess you own, the university owns a bunch of real estate around the campus that really isn't for the university. Explain that.
Well, I mean, we own a lot of buildings now that are, for the most part, unoccupied. You know, or if they are, it's because we've moved, the university has moved some of its employees over to these buildings. And I think that this is, you know, related, I guess, to something that, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, over the last 40 years, you know, what we've seen is this kind of neoliberal attack on all public services and public goods. And whether that's K through 12 education or healthcare or, you know, Social Security. And it's also happened in higher education. And what we've seen is the defunding of public higher education in the United States, the privatization of higher education. And at the same time, you know, for a while, we saw very rapidly escalating tuition, but now many states have also stopped raising tuition. They have not restored, even come close to restoring, even the levels of funding for public higher education that existed before the Great Recession. And even at that point, they had been dramatically reduced. And so universities and colleges have been, in some senses, forced to go out and try and find money elsewhere. And, you know, therefore, you know, they at Wright State, it ended up kind of cooking up a whole bunch of different kinds of schemes, some of which involve real estate and some of which involve creating a research institute that, you know, ended up also losing a lot of money. It was, you know, a failed presidential debate and a whole variety of other things, that none of which are particularly related to the core academic mission of the institution. But they kept on saying, well, we need to do these things because it's going to make money. And of course, in our case, in reality, it ended up losing $131 million in reserves.
And ultimately, you know, clawing back $4 million from your members in quote unquote savings. But you know, the thing is we're seeing this across the country. This isn't unique only to Wright State, is it?
I think that the financial crisis that was created here maybe is somewhat unique to Wright State, but no, those forces are not unique. And actually, just to be clear, there's a lot, the faculty have lost a lot more than $4 million. If that's what the president is saying, that's just one more lie that's coming from the administration, because it's a lot more than $4 million that the faculty have given up.
And again, I'm not surprised, but you know, you brought up the whole neoliberal agenda and this whole privatization, which we've seen, you know, in higher ed especially. I mean, the rise of these for-profit, you know, especially the online colleges that have taken up so many public dollars. It's almost destroyed, I think, higher education in this country. But you know, to your funding point, you know, here in Pennsylvania, where I live, you know, the president of the union here that represents the 14 state-owned universities, he likes to remind me that, you know, back when I went to college in the 80s, The state picked up about the state and the tax base picked up about 3/4 of the cost of higher ed. And the tuition, the student picked up about 1/4. Now that is completely flipped upside down.
Exactly. I mean, and that is, you know, something that to one degree or another is going on all over the country. And you could see it where, you know, it's interesting. You know, I've been making presentations, you know, across the country or doing analyzing the finances of various different colleges and universities across the country for a number of years now. And you can just watch where the two lines have crossed, where, you know, the percentage of revenue that's coming from tuition has been going down and has been going up, and the percentage of revenue that comes from the state has been going down. And, you know, they're in almost all of the states now, the lines have crossed where it's a majority of the revenue comes from tuition. And of course, in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio, maybe Michigan, you know, it's probably in that 75% range of, you know, coming from tuition. And that's, you know, based on the belief that, well, education is a private good, so therefore you should pay for it. Whereas, you know, we believe, the AAUP believes, and, you know, all of our members, that it's a public good, that, you know, it's something that is really for the benefit of society, and that we are here to serve, the universities are here to serve the public good.
You know, I look at this, and again, we're seeing reports, you know, now, I guess, the student loan bubble has, you know, is grown to $1.5 trillion, I guess. And at some point, I think that has to explode as a generation of children are, and young adults are saddled with lifetime debt that they're probably never going to get out from under, which has just, you know, harmed our economy in ways that I don't think a lot of people quite understand. And it's all because we've had this tax cut fetish for the last 40 years to where we've given more and more to the big corporations and the very wealthy at the expense of our young people and our citizens.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, that has, you know, kind of fueled that's been at this tax cutting has been at the center, of course, of this, you know, neoliberal agenda. And, you know, part of it really is an attack on, you know, public higher education, but particular public higher education that serves, you know, working class students. You know, students who come from wealthy families, they're going to get the same kind of quality education that you could get at any, you know, any place, you know. But what's happened is for working class students and even for maybe middle class or, you know, people with even a little bit more income.
Yeah, they're going to be the ones struggling. You know, I mean, I look at this and at the end of it, the sad reality is it's the working class of this country who's going to struggle in all of this and be saddled with a lifetime of debt. And then, you know, punished because, well, they didn't do well. Something wrong. Rudy, I appreciate the time. I wish you guys nothing but the best. And at the end of this, I'd love to hear more as how this works out. Thanks so much. Good stuff. Rudy Fichtenbaum. He is the president of the American Association of University Professors. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think and what you think of what's going on in higher education. I mean, this student loan bubble eventually will pop, and it's going to cause major problems, which is why, again, I think AOC has the right idea, and Bernie Sanders and a lot of progressive politicians. We need to be moving back to the future when education was more affordable and, you know, maybe almost free. Quick break, right back. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, nothing drives me crazier than having that discussion about what we've done to higher education, what we've done to education, not just higher ed, but all education, this push towards privatization, this push towards, you know, ending it as part of the public good, part of the commons, part of the things that we do for the next generation to ensure, oh, I don't know, democracy, societal stability, and oh, maybe cultivate that brain that solves the cancer situation that cures the next disease, that cures the next, you know, ailment, that ends the next epidemic or the next famine or whatever. You know, heaven forbid that we educate the populace to solve the world's problems. No, we've walked away from that. Now it's all for a profit. And we've been doing this now for a generation. And what's interesting is I read an article recently about student loan debt that just, it was one of those things that, and you can get into all the numbers, and there's a lot of numbers there and a lot of stories. But what grabbed me was one little factoid that this person wrote in the article. They said that, you know, back in the 50s when grandma went to college, grandma paid like $2,000 to go to this school and get her degree, which would have come out to about $14,000 a year in today's dollars, which is kind of, it's still a lot of money, but it's not insurmountable. It's not one of those things where you should go, I can't possibly come up with, you know, some of that. They pointed out that, you know, back in the 50s, what grandma paid would have been about $14,000 in today's dollars. I would say, you know, still a little high, but, you know, but somewhat more doable. The person pointed out that in today's dollars, the same college that grandma went to back in the 50s, and paid $14,000, was $52,000 a year now. And you go, now that's outrageous. And what happened? What happened during that time frame? Well, what happened is you have administrators who, like we heard, the people at Wright State made some really, really bad decisions with the money that they had. But moreover, I would argue the situation at Wright State was created by an environment of tax cutting, making these universities stray from their core mission of educating the next generation, and then looking for funding schemes to keep the ship afloat. All because we've had for 40 years this tax cut fetish. And none of this has been highlighted more for me than looking at the Amazon return. Amazon made $11.2 billion in 2018. They had a huge year. In fact, they had such a good year, they doubled. They doubled the year before's numbers because they had $5.6 billion in profit the year before. Now, the year before, the $5.6 billion profit year, still a very good, very respectable profit year, they paid zero taxes, zero federal taxes to our federal government to help fund things like higher education, things like roads and bridges, things like health care. They paid zero federal taxes on $5.6 billion. They are one of Mitt Romney's 47%. This past year, like I said, boom, $11.2 billion in profit. And I was surprised. I was expecting another $0 year. I was expecting another 0%. I was expecting, you know, well, hey, $5.6 billion, zero. $11.2 billion, I was expecting zero. And I was wrong. Thanks to Donald Trump and the Republicans' Tax Cuts Act, not only did they not pay anything in federal taxes, we actually paid them. They had a negative 1.2% federal tax rate. We paid them. And you wonder why tuition keeps going up. You wonder why we keep hearing about this tuition bubble, this student loan bubble that has now grown to $1.5 trillion. And it isn't going anywhere. You know, this article that I was reading, and look, there are hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these stories. Every family has one where the child gets out of high school, does really well in high school, gets into a college, and wants to go to college first in the family. They get accepted, and then they get saddled with massive debt. I've talked to people who've walked out of school $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. I've talked to people who've gone through grad school $100,000 in debt. I've talked to people who've gone through law school $200,000 in debt. And you go, how are you ever going to repay that? And this article was laying out that the one person that they were talking to, you know, did what she was supposed to do. Went to college, got a degree, couldn't find a job anywhere. Ended up getting a job, you know, a menial job somewhere just to put food on the table. Had the student loans frozen, which I guess you can do 6 months after graduation. They accrues no more interest. Then had to put it into forbearance because couldn't pay the amount that was demanded, which about the size of a good car payment, a small mortgage, big car payment. Couldn't pay it. Interest kept accruing. She ended up getting sick, having to take some time off work. Interest kept accruing. And by the time she looked back, the $40,000 that she had in debt was up to about $50,000. Then she got a job and she was able to pay some of it back. Then the recession hit and bang, all of this stuff. And this ebb and flow in income, she's a decade into this and nowhere near touching the principal. It's a lifetime of debt that we've given these kids. And, you know, I look at this Wright State story where this university did everything they could possibly do to screw themselves up by all of these schemes. Now, maybe down the road, the real estate will pay off. Who knows? But on the short term, what they've done is they've created a crisis that, one, they can use to go after their faculty. But, two, they've put their university in peril. And this is a bad thing. All because, and again, I come back to, it's not all their fault. It's this tax cut fetish. It's this neoliberal agenda. It's these policies that think everything that we do, everything that we see, everything, everywhere we want to go, has to come with a profit margin. I mean, stop and think about the world that conservatism is bringing us. Stop and think about the neoliberal future of this country. And yes, I know those words, they go together. Stop and think about what they've brought us. All of the privatization, all of the deregulation. We are moving towards a world to you're going to step out of the front porch of your, on the front porch of your house, and you're going to have to pay somebody to walk across the street. Because we can't pave a road anymore. The Trump agenda was to bring Wall Street in to pave our roads and bridges. Do you think they're going to do that out of the goodness of their heart because they so love the country? No, they're going to do it because they can put up a cash box, an electronic cash box where there's not even a job associated with it. We are heading in a really, really interesting direction where automation is going to take our jobs, privatization is going to take away our rights to anything, and oh, by the way, it's going to cost us whenever we want to do anything. It's infuriating, which is why I'm thrilled to see that there are Democrats who are finally waking up to the reality that something has to be done on this student loan crisis. Something has to be done with our tax rates. Something has to be done to reclaim the commons, to reclaim the things that our grandparents' generation fought for. Understand, we're destroying that greatest generation's legacy. We are destroying that legacy of the next generation doing better. Because I guess, you know, we're still stuck in the greed is good. Hooray for me and the heck with anyone else. It's incredible stuff to me. But not surprising. And at the end of it, it's going to come back to us at the ballot box to turn back, well, the privatization of our nation. Scary stuff. So the tax return fight is heating up. Democrats held a hearing on Trump's tax returns, which again is to me about time. Something that really should have been fleshed out during the campaign. Something that in 2016, we the voting populace should have said, you know what? We demand the tax returns. We need to know what's in there. Because here's the thing. And I've been saying this from the beginning. The more they hold back and the more they say, no, no. We don't need to see Trump's tax return, even though for the last four decades, every presidential candidate has released their tax returns. This guy has said no and been defiant about it. So what it's done is it's made people like me go, well, if you're that defiant, if you're holding that close, and if you're, well, willing to stake your presidency on it, what's in there? And even just the curiosity point of what's he hiding? I think even has to make even a Trump supporter ask that very question. Now, Democrats have said they are going to hold hearings. They have the right, and understand, under the law, they have the ability to get his tax returns. The House Ways and Means Committee has the power to do that. They've had it since the 1920s. They used it during the Nixon era. The Republicans used it during the Obama era to get tax returns of different organizations and to weaponize that committee. And now, what's interesting now is now they're saying, well, you know, Democrats, if you do this, if you do, you go after our guy, we're going to come after you. And not in those terms, in a much more veiled kind of, well, you know, we're going to be back in power someday, according to Devin Nunes. And, you know, we might start looking. Now, you could make an argument of should Congress have the power to get anyone's tax returns? We can have that argument. But the argument today is not, do they have the authority? They do. The law is there. We can argue if there should be that law. And that's something that you can talk about doing away with down the road. But right now, it is the law of the land, and Democrats have oversight power, and they have the ability to get those tax returns. Now, admittedly, nobody knows what's in them. They could be the squeaky cleanest of documents. There could be nothing there whatsoever. And if that is the case, if it is just an embarrassment moment where Trump isn't really as wealthy as he says he is, and he's taken some tax breaks that we already know he's gotten that he didn't deserve or qualify for, that's one thing. Now, there are some who are saying, you know, this could be the proof of a bunch of crimes. This could be that smoking gun of collusion with Russian financiers. This could be all of that stuff in one giant ball of wax. And look, none of us know, which is why I find it interesting that Republicans have basically staked the flag in the ground that don't go there, don't open that door, making them kind of complicit. You know, just, I'll tell you, from the very beginning, to me, the answer was Republicans going in a back door, in a back room kind of way, going, look, here are the tax returns. We're going to set up a special committee. It's going to look at this, going to get Democrats the answers that they need without making everything public. Unless there are crimes there. Now, if there are crimes, you have to report those. But if there's no there, then put it to bed. Seems simple to me. And recently, Representatives Kevin Brady from Texas and Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania wrote a letter to the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal of Massachusetts, imploring him, please, please don't go there. Don't do it. To which I said, wrong side of history. I would be saying, let's go there, but let's narrow the scope. And this is where you kind of got to ask the question, when do Republicans turn and look at Donald Trump and go, there are problems here? And it starts with the tax returns. And I've been saying for a very long time, I don't think as a country we can move in a forward direction without tying up these loose ends that, again, the campaign season should have cleared up. To me, it's that simple. And I'm hoping that in the future, we as voters will demand more of candidates, will demand that we have our questions. So this doesn't happen. And you knew going into this administration that this was going to be one of those clouds over the head of this administration that at some point was going to come back. Now, the president during his State of the Union said and was very clear, again, not a veiled threat. This was an actual threat, saying that, well, you know, we can't have peace and legislation when there's war and investigation. Can't have it. So basically saying, if you go after my tax returns, no peace. And again, you got to ask the question, what's in there? What's in those tax returns? Is it the smoking gun, or is it much ado about nothing? And if it is much ado about nothing, is this just another moment where Trump has done the, well, we got you? We shall soon find out. Love to hear your thoughts. Should we see the tax returns? Is this something Congress should be able to do? Would you want Congress going after your tax returns? Personally, I thought they were a matter of public record that they could look into. That if you filed a false tax return, someone was looking into it. And if you there was a crime there, somebody was overseeing it. We shall see how this plays out. Love to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Speaking of tax returns, initial reports coming out of the IRS filings have shown that, well, tax refunds are about 8% lower than they were the year before, and fewer numbers of people are receiving refunds. And, you know, of course, the Treasury Department pushing back on this, saying, well, it's only a small sample. It's the small initial sample. Yes, the first initial sample, the small initial sample, is showing that returns are lower. And we knew this was going to happen because, look, what the administration did, what Republicans thought was a great idea, was to go after things that working class people use. For instance, and I've been telling a lot of my union brothers and sisters this, thanks to Donald Trump, your union dues will no longer be deductible. The fact that, you know, miles traveled for work, no longer going to be deductible. Transportation, meals, expenses, all of that stuff that you have become accustomed to being able to write off of your taxes, because it's money that comes out of your pocket that you use for work, that will no longer be part of what you can itemize as an unreimbursed employee expense. It's just, it's gone. And it's one of those things that, as someone who, you know, as a truck driver, away from home, and get ready for this, because most truck drivers in this country seem to be big Trump supporters. I'm waiting to hear the squealing on the CBs when they can no longer deduct their meal expenses while they're on the road. That could be up to about $50 a day, because the per diems that the IRS allowed you to have, depending on the city you were in, were between $50 and $55 a day, which could total, you know, somewhere, you know, $13,000-$14,000 a year in unreimbursed employee expenses, which now gone, completely gone. Business liability insurance, gone. You can no longer deduct that. Depreciation on your computer, your cell phone, things that you're required to use in your work, gone. And like I said, union dues, part of that as well. And you throw in all of the other things. If you have a home office, if you have work-related education expenses, all gone. All gone. And again, as I've been saying for a while, this administration and these Republicans did what they've been talking about doing for years, which is more punishing of workers. Understand, big business, corporate America, they can still deduct those things. You and me, not so much. The other thing that I like to remind people, you know, if you have work-related clothes, you know, and a lot of people in construction, you know, wear, you know, buy clothes for work, special shoes, you know, hard hats, you know, vests, you know, gloves, all kinds, no more. And you start to think about, you know, why are the initial returns lower? Well, the initial returns are lower because those deductions that working people used to take to help defray some of the costs of having a job have now been taken away. Now, I've often argued that, you know, work gloves and boots and stuff like that needed for the job, cell phones and computers and all that stuff needed for the job should be provided by the job. But we don't live in that era anymore. We don't live in an era where the demands of the workforce are somehow met. And I would argue it has everything to do with the declining union density in this country and the fact that fewer people join and belong to labor unions. And not by choosing, because look, most people that I talk to have a favorable view of labor unions and would love to join one if they had the ability. The problem is the pendulum has swung way too far in the hands of big business and corporate America. What needs to happen is we need to say enough of and this, maybe this is that moment. Maybe it's going to take the shot to the pocketbook. Maybe it's going to take the shot to the wallet. That's going to make us wake up and realize that the Republican Party is not the party of the working class. And this could be a moment where Democrats wake up and go, hey, we can once again be the party of the working class. And go back and look at these things. You know, I've been saying for years, and you go back to, you know, the tax reform bill of 86, where they began taxing unemployment, which, you know, again, to me, one of the biggest slaps in the face to working people ever. You've lost your job, you've lost your income. The replacement rate of unemployment to your lost income is somewhat, then was about half. It's down to about 40% now. And you're going to tax that? It just seems like a major slap in the face. But what do we expect? And I look at these cuts that they've made, because, hey, we've got to figure out how to pay for those huge tax cuts for the very wealthy and big business. It's going to harm average, everyday working people. Now, understand, this tax law sunsets in 2025. So, as I understand, in 2025, if nothing happens, all of that stuff comes back. But think of all the revenue and all the money that you're going to lose in the process. Because, hey, we've got to pay for the tax cuts for the very wealthy. Does any of that apply to you? Do you buy trade-related magazines or educational material that you use for your job? Clothing. You know, think about all of the things that you purchase to do your job. Legal fees, any of that. All no longer deductible. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Angry about this or not surprised? Right back. This week we saw an interesting week of legislation as Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders introduced his Social Security Expansion Act and Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow introduced Medicare at 50. Sanders' plan, a lot like Larson's plan from Connecticut, only the idea scrapped the cap a little sooner. Larson's plan was at 400,000. Sanders is at 250, having a donut hole between the 132,000 that you pay taxes up to now and the 250 that Sanders would put it at. And eventually inflation would go up. Interesting that he wants to expand and also allow for greater funds to be paid out for folks to be able to survive. I think it's a step in the right direction and most certainly something we're going to be talking about in the coming weeks. Also, Stabenow's Medicare at 50, going to lower the Medicare age, allow you to buy into Medicare, helping people 50 years and older, make it to 65 by allowing them to get Medicare at a younger age and also make it part of the Affordable Care Act. I think a huge, huge piece of legislation. Both things we will be talking about in the coming weeks. But my new favorite piece of legislation comes from the state of New Jersey, where legislation was recently introduced in the state Senate there that would guarantee workers who are part of a mass layoff, you know, like we saw at Toys R Us and Sears, people who are involved in a mass layoff would be guaranteed 1 week of severance pay for every year they worked for the company. To me, this is a huge step forward. And they define mass layoff as layoffs with 50 or more employees. So small mom and pops, they're not going to be affected. So don't allow the right wing to scare us into, well, we can't know. It would only be for people laid off 50 or more. They're also proposing to increase the amount of time that employers have to give employees who are going to be affected by a mass layoff. From the current 60 days, which is mandated under the Federal WARN Act, up to 90 days, and with a pretty severe punishment. If they fail, even by a day, to give that 90 days notice, and they fail to give that proper notice, that would trigger a minimum 4 weeks of severance, no matter how long the person has been on the job, plus the 1 week per year of service severance, which I think is great. This could be a huge step forward, especially as we head into an era of, I believe, an era of rapid automation and, of course, the coming tsunami of job losses that are expected to come with it. Now, you know, when I saw this, I'm going, you know, I was talking about this back in 2009, when we were losing, you know, a million jobs a month and employers were just shedding people like crazy. I said, we got to have something like this to stop some of the job loss and to make it more expensive to get rid of workers. So there's an incentive to keep people on the job so we don't have massive layoffs. We don't have the kind of bottom falling out that we saw in 2009. And also what I was arguing back then is instead of the states having to pick up, you know, all of the costs of a mass layoff, the employer should pick some of it up. And in this legislation, this severance, many states, like where I'm at in Pennsylvania, if you get severance, they push off your unemployment several weeks. So you're going to get a nice lump sum, help you find another job. But if your severance runs out, then unemployment is there as a backup. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's going to help the state coffers, and it's going to help people maybe make that transition. So this is going to be one of those pieces of legislation to keep an eye on, you know, along with, you know, raising the minimum wage, which New Jersey did. It will be $15 an hour in 2024, along with, you know, making, you know, better working conditions, you know, along with pushing for paid leave and paid, you know, family leave and paid vacations and stuff like that. This is important too, I think. And, you know, this is something that unions used to do and still do. Now we're seeing legislation moving in that direction. I think this is a good thing, and it's going to be something worth watching. So it's an interesting week of legislation, obviously stuff we're going to talk about into the coming weeks. And I'll tell you, I am thrilled to see Democrats taking back the House and, you know, in New Jersey where they control just about everything, and really pushing for very pro-worker legislation, pushing to make workers' lives better. To me, that's got to be where the Democratic Party goes, back to being the party of working people. Because look, we know the Republicans are the party of big business. We know that. And it came out in this legislation where the hair on fire Chamber of Commerce and everyone else, no, we can't do this, it's bad. I think it's a step in the right direction. I'd love to hear what you think. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Is this a good piece of legislation? Is it a good idea? Medicare at 50, is that a good idea? Social Security Expansion Act? I'd love to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next week. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1688. That was the day Germantown Quakers gathered to petition against slavery in the first documented anti-slavery protest in America. Quaker colonists in Barbados began to question slavery in the 1670s. By 1688, founder of Germantown, Francis Daniel Pastorus, and three other Quakers met at Thones Cudner's house to craft a petition. They urged their fellow congregants to abolish slavery. The petition detailed its opposition to the importation, sale, and ownership of slaves. Rooted in the Golden Rule, "Do unto others as they would do unto you," the men questioned why Christians would own slaves when they would not own each other. They argued that slaves had broad universal rights, including the right to engage in slave revolts in order to assure their freedom. The petition traveled its way through the Quaker network, but many felt it was too weighty a matter on which to take a position. Those Germantown settlers who felt strongly about ending slavery left the Quaker community for the Mennonites. Over the course of the next century, Quakers in Germantown would craft strong anti-slavery petitions that influenced the broad Quaker community in Philadelphia to take a formal stand. By the time of the American Revolution, Philadelphia Quakers published numerous attacks on the institution in Benjamin Franklin's newspaper. They formally banned the ownership of slaves at their Philadelphia yearly meeting in 1776. Throughout the region, Quakers routinely raised funds for those who had escaped escaped bondage to start new lives and help them integrate into the Quaker communities. Quakers would continue to play a prominent and active role in the abolitionist movement and the Underground Railroad. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.